This is Robert Stark. I'm here with Pillator. We're going to be discussing the psychologist Erik Erikson. He is best known for his theories on psychosocial development and the series of stages in life and the kind of expectations you're expected to have at each stage, and the development of the human psyche through the stages. Pillator, great having you on.
It's nice talking to you, Robert.
You wrote an article about this on your blog, Erik Erikson's A Psychosocialism and Introduction.
Yes, I wrote that. You know, the first time I ever heard of Erik Erikson was probably my first freshman year in college when I was looking at psychology and coming across the psychosocial behavior. I found it very strange, and not only that it was ironic, but it was close to the truth. You know, when somebody makes a joke online and tries to put everyone in like a pigeonholed box, I think Erik Erikson did it in such a professional and psychological professional way. It shows something about the Western way of living and about life in general, and why most people have problems, why people have good lives, bad lives, and at the same time, not only is that we suffer under psychosocial, socialism, you have to understand, too, that, you know, one of the most important philosophers we had in the Western tradition was Martin Heidegger, and Heidegger argued that there's time and being, and that we have to understand philosophy by having a camera over our heads and look at, you know, what is time and being, or like being loyal to our Dasein. However, at the same time, Erik Erikson built upon that and created a very scientific psychosocial chart, which particularly means whether we're honest with our Dasein or we're dishonest, or we basically kind of suffer under psychosocialism. Some people really enjoy it. Some people are losers to the game, but we never had a third position to break out of it. I mean,
yeah, that's kind of, that's kind of the notion in culture. I mean, it's a human condition, but I think especially in American culture, there's this notion that everyone has to become successful and fit this mold, and if you're not, you're a loser. And I guess the way things kind of worked in traditional times and in the past is you were kind of born into this group or tribe or strict kind of caste system. And if you were kind of born a peasant, you were going to die a peasant. And I guess, but you had some kind of solace in knowing that what your fate was. But American kids are kind of brought up that everyone can be a millionaire, or children are taught that they can be president. And then you go for this kind of phase, in high school, you discover your sexuality, you start checking out girls, and then you think, I'm going to get this girl, and then you have your kind of a dream job in college. Then a lot of people go for the kind of trauma of the high school college experience of if they say they fail socially or romantically, then people go out into the workforce, and maybe they don't get the job that they want to have. And they struggle in life. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it is there are these kind of expectations that you're supposed to have these specific things by a certain time. And there's the psychological aspect. Then there's also the kind of a cultural conditioning in our society.
You know, it's the reason why the biggest losers of them all is Elliot Rodgers when he 24 years old, writes his manifesto, My Twisted World, and shoots up the place because he basically, not that he failed, but because the at the age of, you know, 24, his virtues, you know, of loving, and he was questioning with the existential question of that, could he love? And the annoying part was he was suffering through these things. Now, ironically, according to a psychosocial argument, that if there, you know, you might side this in someone of a YouTube chat, if Elliot Rodgers was to have sex or have a girlfriend before this, none of it would happen. He would be blissfully within the cog of the system, right? But he's kind of like this outsider, that kind of is asking the dark sides, and there's always a consequence to these things. Now, if another result is MGTOW, right? The whole MGTOW movement is basically men who are accepting their own standard, being themselves, and were just in the wrong position at the wrong time. And the psychosocial crisis, you know, of those things, what they were battling against, led them to MGTOW, is because they had to basically, at the age of 18, you're supposed to bang and have girlfriends. You know, you can't delay it until you're like 29. You have, you know, and so there's this social pressure, this cultural pressure called psychosocialism that is omnipresent and around us everywhere.
Yeah, those are examples of how people kind of react to that. In the case of the MGTOWs, there are people who are kind of saying, oh, the system is rigged against me, I'm just going to drop out. And Elliot Rodgers' philosophy is, if the system is rigged against me, I'm just going to destroy, I'm just going to destroy things in a kind of nihilistic, like, blaze. And what's interesting about Rodgers' philosophy, if you analyze his manifesto, he's not, for starters, he's not like an egalitarian leftist saying, this world, this is an unjust world, we need to have complete equality. His argument is just that he's acknowledging that we do have hierarchies in society, but that he personally deserves better, that he personally deserves to be higher on the hierarchy. And I think a lot of people feel that way. I mean, he's an extreme example, even yes. I mean, even people who are like total normies. But I think there's all these kind of conflated messages in society, because on one hand, there's all this messages that you have to have this kind of social status and certain things, as you mentioned, materialistic things, to be a so-called winner as opposed to being a loser. But then there's also these kind of like phony egalitarian messages where children are taught that we're all the same, and people are taught about equality.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of that really confuses people psychologically.
It's a poor way of trying to break out of the psychosocial narrative by telling everyone has the same advantages and everybody can do the same. Now, it's good to believe that, yet at the same time, psychosocialism, with the word like socials within it, has definitely an egalitarian basis to it. This time it's not political socialism or national socialism. It's psychosocialism. The ideal that everyone is in their own little Discord server, Skype chat, internet place. Now with the advent of the internet, you know, the word normie is an insult to anyone who's following the psychosocial narrative to the normal person life. You have to think about, you know, an early psychological concept of Maslow's hierarchy of needs pyramid. You know, at the bottom you have psychological safety, love and belonging, esteem, self-actualization. Maslow believed everyone had a pyramid. Now, if you think of Erica Erickson's psychosocial development or psychosocialism, it's really a bunch of Maslowian pyramids on top of each other at certain ages. You have a unique pyramid starting at the age of, you know, 0 to 23 months. Then you have a new Maslow pyramid, 2 to 4, 5 to 4. You know, it goes so quick. But the biggest pyramids are basically 5 to 12 years, 13 to 19 years, and 20 to 39 years. There's three pyramids.
Yeah, those are kind of the crucial years, your teen years and 20 years, because that's kind of the age where you have to kind of establish yourself as an adult. There's a kind of relationship issue. People are told, you have to, like, lose your virginity by a certain age.
Exactly.
You have to get a job. You have to make this much money, get a college degree. I mean, that's when there's the most pressure. Little kids kind of have their issues, and then older adults have a stress from – they have their stress taking care of their kids or taking care of their bills. And then the other thing is, then you have the people who maybe hit – there's people who hit 40, and they have these kind of like midlife crises, or I don't even know if I'd use the word midlife crisis, people who've just kind of – they reach middle age and they've never reached those goals of adulthood even.
Yes, exactly. Because if you basically have a terrible childhood or terrible questioning, you're going to have pretty much a fucked up following pyramid following after that. You know, it's said that to the maturity, the very last Maslowian pyramid and the psychosocial development, you ask yourselves that if it's okay to be you, but and you reflect on life. However, what if it wasn't okay to be you, and you're basically selfish and you fear death? And you're basically not this grandpa that wants longevity to the world. You're basically this coward, basically almost like a teenager, but you're 60 to 70 years old. And so you see this with people, that there is a definitely an IQ and age difference with people, that a 50-year-old can act like a 28-year-old and work at a shitty job, a night shift, lifting boxes and trucks, you know, and somehow starting a family, right? This is basically like the white middle class. Now, another thing I want to bring up really quick is Paul Fussell. Paul Fussell was like a really funny cultural critic. He had a book called Class. And in this book, it's kind of like a comical version of The Bell Curve. You know, kind of like that old school book, How to Lie with Statistics. But in Class, Paul Fussell's Class, he talks about that America is really ruled by the lower class, the middle class, the upper middle class, and the upper class. Now, the upper class runs everything. They're basically decadent and depraved. They have all the accesses, and they create the culture, you know. They are, you know, the middle political force, and they do what they want. Now, ironically, the middle and lower classes, the middle class is just worried because it doesn't want to be lower. It just wants to survive and get by. And that's what they do. And lower class is scared, you know. They're poor. They could be blacks and, you know, somewhere in the city, or they could just be trailer trash. And then you have the upper middle class, which is basically the middle class with a trust fund and tons of money. And because they don't know what to do with this money, turns out the upper middle class, as Paul Fussell writes in his book, Class, that they're overly educated, that they have master degrees, they have a fake sense of aristocracy. They think by knowing a certain discipline, like philosophy or psychology, will make them elites. But the truth is the upper class knows the follies of the upper middle class, and they point that out, and they don't let them in the private Ivy League schools.
Well, the upper middle class, they're not really. Trust fund is like, those are the people. I mean, there's like measly trust funds, I suppose. But like the stereotype of someone is like the children of like multimillionaires and billionaires who have these massive trust funds with unlimited money.
Yes.
And they can just kind of do whatever they want. The upper middle class are the strivers. They're the ones who are kind of constantly under pressure and stress to kind of upkeep their social status and prove that they're part of the upper middle class and sort of keep up with that.
Now, if you think, even it goes by names too, like poor people will have like any from crazy to esoteric names. Now, middle class names are like Timothy Jackson, Greg Johnson, John Doe, Joe Rock. Even these are upper middle class names too. And if you have a name like Dr. Timothy Jackson, right, you have names that are basically mundane, and you teach at Nebraska University in about political whiteness, right? This isn't a upper class thing.
And yeah, that's an interesting point, is like there's the kind of jokes about like ghetto, like there's like the ghetto black names or even like the redneck names. And then, like, a lot of rich people give their kids, like, these really silly names. I mean, there's kind of, like, the old wealth, like, pretentious name.
I was about to get to that.
And then you have, like, these, like, celebrities giving their kids, like, I think, I don't, all kinds of weird names.
Apple's a pilot and
stuff. Yeah, Apple or stuff like, I think that was Gwyneth Paltrow, but just really silly stuff.
Yeah, and it's like a redneck who names her daughter Mercedes after the car. And there are other lower middle class whites. They'll name their baby daughter Aiko, like some foreign Japanese name, because they're watching some bumfuck anime, right? And so, yet at the same time, the middle and upper middle classes have biblical names or Irish background names. And the upper class has English to eccentric multicultural names, or Jewish / names, you know, classic. But, you know, that according to, now apply Paul Fussell's theory about class to Eric Erickson's psychosocialism, we now have four different classes with each eight different Maslowian pyramids into each one. And so psychosocialism vastly differs as well by class structure. And so...
So you're saying if the Maslow's hierarchy of needs is someone could skip the needs to one of the things at the top of the pyramid, like self-actualization, but miss the middle things. I mean, is that possible?
Yes, and Now, Eric Erickson, psychosocialism, there's like 8 pyramids in one, and they're always changing. You can't just stop time and go in a freezer and redo this. If you mistake and if you're ignorant and dumb, you mess up. It's why people are a lot reading Return of the Kings and works by Aaron Clary, is because it's this Manosphere red pill knowledge, or at least this iron pill. And so people get caught up in, you know, if you're 17 right now, you should bang a lot of girls and go on Tinder and do this. And yet at the same time, that is a product of today's generation. I was never told to do that. I didn't know what I was at 17. And to this day, I still feel that I'm a 19-year-old in an early 20s body. I feel like I've been, I don't mean to say I'm retarded. I officially declare myself mentally delayed. I just am feeling that because of my background, I feel like a 19-year-old in an early 20s body. That might have something to do with probably my school age, questioning the ideal that can I make it in the world of people and things, and maybe I couldn't, maybe I was bullied. Maybe it's also true that turns out that, you know, especially in the upper class, if you're on books all the time, you don't get to be with girls. What if you're locked up in a library and you're never told to be around other girls and you develop a homosexuality? Or you develop this weird, at a vital time when you're supposed to learn that. And yet, you're older and you're lonely and you want girls. And yet, at the same time, you can't because somebody put you in the wrong position at the wrong time, right? So, like this, and it's also, finally, I'm putting in something too generational. Not only am I talking about Paul Fussell's class and Eric Erickson's psychosocialism, I'm also talking about generations. Because generations change, especially from the Victorian era to today. And to be a Victorian man, you know, with the burly mustache and this, they had different expectations to be a man back then than it is to, what, read Ruch V's Game Bang book?
Yeah, like, going throughout history, every society has its rite of passage. Like, a primitive tribe in the jungle, like, maybe, like, they have some weird rite of passage, or maybe it's just hunting for the first time. I mean, obviously, sex is, like, the big one. Can't avoid that.
Now, it's one of the most revelating books I've read was Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. That book was basically, if you imagine a future generation, the whole psychosocialism thing understood. And then yet, they have these people named off of, what, Bernard Marx, and names of this weird cultural Marxist future where people are having babies by the second, and you're just a gear in the cog, and you have no life outside of it. And everyone is perfectly and exact that line. It's kind of scary to think about, and yet we have that today. I wrote particularly Eric Erickson's Psychosocialism in my article for AsianArianism.com, specifically for my ideology, AsianArianism, the ideal that whites and Asians in the American and today's context should have a bond together. That is purely a development of psychosocialism. I think psychosocialism predates AsianArianism because what has happened in the Gen X time and in the early millennials, the Gen X's were probably doing business in Japan and had a fascination with it. And the millennials were watching Toonami and playing video games and Final Fantasy, and they had this high expectation of Asian American women as being living anime characters. So I think a lot of geeky whites pursued them. And today we now have this 20 years later Eurasian, or at least it's now the norm for whites to date Asian women because...
Well, yeah, because I think this issue affects millennials the most because millennials were brought up with all this wealth and prosperity, and you could say they were spoiled in a sense, but they were totally screwed over, but they were told by their parents and teachers that they were going to amount to all these great things. Then they kind of witnessed the biggest economic decline, and you're seeing all these people who are unemployed. And it's getting to the point where, I mean, even kids from upper middle class backgrounds with college degrees are now unemployed or are working at jobs way below their level. I mean, there's issues of economics and poverty, but I mean, putting that aside, I mean, people have a tendency to just focus on economics from a materialistic standpoint, But people ignore the psychosocial aspects of things.
Yes.
Even if someone, like people, there's a kind of cliche, like, oh yeah, don't feel bad about yourself because people in Africa are starving.
Exactly.
Or people in this country are much poorer than you. But people's base their identity, how their social status it relates to their environment. And there is this another sociologist and philosopher, Alain de Botton. And de Botton is someone who is, I'd say he's considered pretty mainstream. And he's like constantly on TED Talks, but he has this book called The Architecture of Happiness. And he talks he has a film called Status Anxiety. And I would recommend looking up his work because he talks a lot about this theme about how people's sort of base their identity and happiness on their perception of their social status around them.
It's not only that, but there's a new internet. We learn a lot from the internet, but there's a new word that's very interesting, and that's LARPing, live action role playing. Now, we're not talking about Larry Niven's Dream Park or Dragonair battle games, like the old school, like LARPing, live action role playing. We're not talking about that. I've said this in my article. We're talking about people who are basically disguising their roles and pretending they are a living anime character, pretending they are a Waspian character. This is the victim. This is what the upper middle class does. They fall for education because they want to be like their professors. They want to read the New York Times. This is something what Kevin McDonald says, by the way. They want to be these things. All the white girls want to be feminists is because they're LARPing. You know, this is a cute lowbrow term for it. But there's another psychologist that was very Albert Bandura, who had the Bobo doll experiment. Now, whatever you say about him, his argument was basically that with the Bobo doll, everything is learnt behavior. That what monkey see, monkey do. What I do, you do back. And so that's a very bleak view of life. That's kind of like when E.O. Wilson said we're a bunch of ants and we basically follow for nationalism and all that fun stuff. But Bandura basically said if evil people do evil things, we're going to follow that because there's some signs in our brains that thinks that's cool. So if you're in a class of other people and I start seeing other white men with Asian girlfriends, I'm gonna irrationally hack on to that, you know, take notice to that, and I'm going to get myself an Asian girlfriend. And it creates culture. Now, when you start to self-actualize this stuff, it becomes pretty much a political movement. Or, you know, some people don't like it when you disturb nature. But this LARPing.
So your point about LARPing is people often say that, like, a lot of political dissident stuff is just LARPing. But you're saying stuff starts out as LARPing, and if enough people do it, it becomes a genuine culture. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it can be, but sometimes it's not. Like Sweppel, like Christian Lander's book, Stuff White People Like. Sometimes white people do these things, like listening to acoustic covers of rap songs, wearing plaid shirts, vegan restaurants, what have you. However, if you point that out to a white person, their nature is disturbed, and so they'll call you racist or something. But enough people could make it into an established culture, and it could lead to something. However, this is, again, have a lot to do with the psychosocial narrative, because people are LARPing, and they're constantly asking questions about their life. Especially in our 20s, we're going to be looking for, you know, friends and partners. We think about love every day before we go to bed. We masturbate to the ideals of our ideal girlfriends. We ask ourselves, can we love? And we think about, I don't care about going to the bar. Where's my romantic relationship? We need that. We're hardwired for that. But we can't get those things is because we might be in bad situations. We might be lower class, or you might even be upper class and have it like on a silver platter. But this is what develops disorders and mental illnesses is when we don't get these things on demand. Now, the thing is, if supposedly we were to get them on demand all the time, we'd be spoiled like the Kim Kardashians or the Kardashian families, right? They get everything, and they're basically the rulers of the world. And the sick truth of it is, it might as well be the true fact that maybe Erickson's theory is obsolete, is because if you were to follow psychosocialism and try to live a great life, you basically created the Gen X generation that told all their trids they can be anything what they want, so as long as they answer the psychosocial question. And that has became such silly shit like the high school prom. Everybody on film has boyfriend, girlfriend. The college experience. Working. You know, these bullshit mundane things, you know? It's a system to basically sedate you in sleep. And so that's kind of my criticism of psychosocialism. And yet, no one is asking questions to break out of the mold. We constantly either have to adapt to psychosocialism or win at psychosocialism. We just can't break out of it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, looking at different solutions, it's kind of you're saying you can't. A lot of people feel that they have to either adapt to it or drop out, and kind of I sent you an interesting article by Giovanni Donato, but he kind of talks about the whole concept of having a college degree and how it's kind of become worthless. I think a perfect example of like LARPing is this kind of idea that everyone has to get a college degree. And basically, originally, a college degree is just this, like, it was a basic competency test for a job, but it's become this whole industry for the whole, like, scam with the bankers and the student loan debt and the whole education bureaucracy. And, I mean, there's an aspect of a self-actualization, but sure, but a lot of it is just that people are convinced and would make more sense just to bring back like IQ test and then either take into account IQ tests for job applications or have some kind of a economic system of a form of a socialism where we have socialism but it favors people with higher IQs because, I mean, that's obviously not egalitarianism, but it takes out a lot of the bullshit of the whole system that we have today.
Yes, it's like it's the bell curve, really, because the bell curve, Eric Erickson was before when Charles Murray developed the bell curve, and the bell curve states the truth of the cognitive elite. And if you have an high IQ, America works for you. And it's interesting too, in Aaron Clary's book Worthless, he states that the only degree that is worth something is STEM, science, technology, education, math, or engineering and math. And to do those disciplines are actually hard, and most people cannot do them. It requires a high IQ and good health to do them. And not everyone could commit 7 to 8 years of their life or more doing that. I mean, certainly you'll get a starting job and a beginning salary, but most people would rather get educated in the quote-unquote worst degrees, as Aaron calls them. Now, you're not safe even if you do get a STEM degree, because in the economy, it means that the STEM, it's certainly you could do that, and the economic situation is you get paid by how much labor you put in, right? Your contribution to society. And the truth is that it becomes a really corrupt situation when everyone starts going for STEM, where it turns out everybody in the middle, upper middle class family is a pharmacist, a biochemist, a whatever, right? And they still do decadent things. They just have a quote unquote job, because really we're just getting jobs, right? And then doing decadent things beforehand. So there's always worth. So my rebuttal to Clary's Worthless book is that the degrees are not worthless because you can make sense with it in the market. It's just the problem is the market is going against the college degree, and everything is so inflated, and there are a lot of crummy institutions in America that have to be, like, destroyed. Like, they've been recently turning all the women's colleges into men's schools, which is another proxy. That just shows you how corrupt everything is. And there's basically, I think Paul Fussell said this too. In England, you have, like, 20 or 30 or something education institutions. But in America, you get, in Ohio, you get 100 in one single state. I thought that was funny. But it just shows you how much we're inflated by institutions. Nobody cares if I go to River Creek community college out in Alabama, and I graduated with English in, you know, Florida State University or Mickenmyers of Florida. What the fuck's a Mickenmyers, right? Nobody can remember all this bullshit. It's just, it's, you know, and so that itself is psychosocial. Nobody cares you went to that girls' school in New York because hardly anyone goes to it. And yet people are now developing this weird Blade Runner cyberpunk, you know, it looks like Neuromancer worlds of just bubbles and bubbles and discords, is because people are getting against the collective and creating psychosocial narratives within a bigger psychosocial narrative. And this is quite dangerous.
You have a lot of, like, kind of high IQ, like, nerdy types who have this notion, like, I'm intelligent and I'm automatically going to be successful. Obviously, I mean, you do need a significantly high IQ. I mean, that's a big advantage, of course. But what a lot of people don't get is a lot of becoming successful and rising up in your both your social and economic status. A lot of it has to do with how much social capital you have, how many your connections to people, and one aspect of that is how good you are socially, your social skills, your social intelligence. But the other aspect of that is kind of conforming to the, like, quote-unquote, like, normie values of society. And if you have your own values or culture that doesn't click with normie values, then even if you do have a high IQ, you're still going to be marginalized.
Exactly, or be some minority, like a Muslim, right? That's what that they're always talking about. Liberals talk about how they were the different one because nobody else was like them. You know, that's a cheesy thing, but relating this, you know, I was embarrassed. I still am embarrassed in high school. I think I graduated high school when I was, like, you know, late 19, right? And so, you know, getting out of college, still in my early 20s, it's kind of embarrassing that it's like some people, you know, there's this, people do say, you know, there's this whole manosphere argument saying that college is worthless, don't go, be a welder. Okay, but what if you're 30-something and, like, you basically are told, whoa, you don't have a college degree, you must be a nincompoop like a high school student. Some people believe that. That is the psychosocial narrative in motion. And if you're 32, they expect you to have a kid. And so most people marry off at that age. It's even stranger, too, that people like F. Roger Devlin, in his amazing book Sexual Utopian Power, tells you how bleak the relationship is between white male and white female. It seems perfectly natural for a 22-year-old white male to marry like an 18 or 19-year-old white female, or even younger between those ages, and then start a family and have 5 kids. Great. However, that's not happening today. What's happening is early 20-year-old white girls are being married off to 30-year-old white guys. And white males in their 20s just get fucked by these white girls who are slut feminists and don't know any better.
The thing is, with the women from the upper middle class, I mean, most of them are waiting. I mean, the average age of marriage for upper middle class women is, I'd say it's probably close to 30. I mean, a lot of these women are marrying well into the 30s.
Yeah, it's weird because I'm for, like, a healthy living of life, and I think that it's natural for this is me being hetero. I believe that a, you know, white male or just a male of should marry someone, a female, a year or 2 or 3 years younger than him. But because everyone's such an autonomized individual in the Western world, and because of this different generations and crazy psychosocialism going on, it's supposedly natural to date sugar moms and cougars and guys prey upon little Chinese girls. And I've yet to write an article from my own observations of middle-class Asian elitism that I see a lot of 30-something-year-olds preying upon 22 Asian girls without any control behind that. Or, you know, it's not just that. It's just there's this weakness.
I think it's natural for men to prefer women who are much younger. I mean, that's...
It is. But yeah. This is at an unbalanced rate. This is at a rate where they're manipulating and cheating the system, where it shows you it's the ugly duckling allegory or metaphor that Devlin uses them.
Yeah, that's the thing, as you were saying, because men at that younger age who are, say like 18, if they're not successful, they have to build up their economic power. And then once they get to the point where they reach that economic power, if they do succeed, obviously, if they have options, they're going to want to be with someone much younger. Yeah.
Oh, the ugly duckling, here's what happens. In the ages of teenagers and 20s, the white male, he's basically made fun of. He's bullied. He can't get a girl. However, the white female, and during those ages, she's a slut. She's promiscuous. She's doing whatever. Now, ironically, when the white male gets to 30, he's successful. He has an Adam's apple. He grows body hair. He looks more handsome. He's fully grown, and he's more powerful. On the other hand, the woman who's 30 is having a crisis because she can't be the little slut she was when she was 20. And now she has to marry quickly with people age. Now, this is really screwing up stuff because those white guys are basically fulfilling their psychosocial narratives. You know, when they were asking what is love, now that they're age of 30, they can basically cheat the system and get their little Asian girlfriend they always wanted. There's this trad argument or this white nationalist argument. If you look at the life currently right now of Matthew Heimbach, I think Matthew Heimbach is 24 years old. He's married now and he's got a kid because he's been trying to forcefully follow his psychosocial narrative, and he's been asking those big questions to himself as a radical student, but he's also following the political ideology of white nationalism. It shows you just how young and naive, not even naive, it shows you how whimsical these young kids are. They have these plans already out of them and want to live their life as an anime, the Matthew Heimbach anime. And he's doing it because he probably has the money and means to do so. Every kid wants to live out that life at the same time.
I don't think it's about this, about living this fantasy. I guess when it comes to marriage, I guess people who are born into more traditional conservative religious cultures get married early. But for the sort of upper class, it's more common to get married when they're older. So I don't know that much about Matthew Heimbach's background. I think he is religious. I think he was in some kind of like Eastern Orthodox church. But you do have a lot of these certain cultures like Orthodox Judaism and Hinduism. Like they have arranged marriages.
The caste system in
Hinduism is like they have like forced arranged marriages. Like in Orthodox Judaism, it's not like Hinduism, but they have like sort of matchmaking. But they do take into account like what is this person's education and intelligence level.
It's just like National Socialism, right? They had Hitler Youth and the Hitler this and that, and basically you were told by a dictator government to be a supreme blonde gentleman. You had everything on fire. That's why people loved fascism and communism, because it was the psychosocial narrative as a government implied. And that's why you had so much grid collective. And that's why I always think what's this, the secret white nationalism message is a love for Eric Erickson's psychosocialism. Think of the word psychosocialism. It's right in there in the words. Now,
is it psychosocialism or just psychosocial as in sociology?
You could be talking about sociology.
Socialism implies like not necessarily egalitarianism, but I guess some kind of equilibrium. And that's kind of the thing. I mean, we were talking about this theme when we talked to Richard about Wollstonecraft, about Ghost in a Shell.
Yeah.
And the sort of liberal, atomized society, it puts out this sugar-coated narrative, but in a sense, it is a lot more cruel system than a lot of these ideologies that would be described as more authoritarian. I mean, I'm not in favor of full-on fascism or full-on communism, but I guess what we need is some kind of social nationalism, basically like a healthy identitarianism, high levels of social capital combined with a social safety net, but it's a smart social safety net, not a kind of social safety net that encourages like degenerate behavior, like kind of what we have now.
Yes.
kind of what I said Giovanni Donato describes as like smart socialism, if you've read his article.
Now, I've read some textbooks as referring to psychosociology or psychosocial as psychosocialism, as a political doctrine and ideology. And that's how I refer to Erik Erikson's belief as an ideology of psycho, because it is, when you start to think about it, as that method, and it becomes more than psychology, it becomes a way of life.
What exactly is the definition of psychosocialism then? Because economic socialism is a sense of redistributing wealth and the means of production. Psychosocialism, you're talking about psychology, your social status, your role in society. Are you? What can you be more specific in what exactly
I would say
is
that
a psychosocialist political agenda?
If you took Erik Erikson's psychosocial development theory and put it as an ideology, you can call it psychosocialism, because that's what you're really up against.
Oh, so you're not saying that he's advocating the explicit political ideology. You're talking about a political ideology based on his ideas.
Exactly. And I think it's been flirted around. It's been used in textbooks. And I think it is this strange thing. I think we are living through a psychosocialism era, and I say it all the time.
Psychosocialism is what we have now that has failed, or psychosocialism is something we should strive for?
That's the problem, and people say they strive for it, and every day people strive for it, and people are in the system. Now, I am kind of the anarchist. I'm the puppet master in Ghost in the Shell. I want to break out of it, because either improve or break out of it, because if we break out of it, like the Depeche Mode song Stripped, maybe we can understand a more, that's not just materialism, right? It's when some sleazy Manosphere guy tells you it's all about banging chicks and doing this. It's like, who cares? What about your standards? I guess this is an alt-left position, but it's the ideal that, why should this whole, you know, Erik Erikson, alright, psychology is great and all, it's just a theory, but if this really is the point to life, then why can't we just break out of it and create something that we are fully happy with, or even get those questions, right? We all deserve, at this age, love, a girlfriend, and to be at the top of the pyramid. But because of things in life, the upper class has those things, and we do not. And so there should be this right, this new, I'm calling for a new age ideology, whether that'll improve on psychosocialism or criticize it, and basically get the things we want now. And we don't have a lot of those things now. We are basically are struggling. Like, today, I'm sick and tired of the whole identity politics where basically, people, everything's a consumer lifestyle choice. When somebody asks you, somebody, you go up to someone and say, I'm single. Oh, how's great being single? It's like, it's not great being single. And then somebody goes,
or even people talk about being like LGBT and transgender, like it's a consumer
psychosocial
identity. Yeah.
Living, they're asking questions.
Basically what you're saying with advocating this psychosocial ideology or even movement, I think you're really getting onto something, but I think the next step is actually putting forth ideas. Is the solution just changing the culture and the way people think, or do you think there are actual policies that should be implemented?
I think, that's what we have today. Those policies implemented are like, go to college, right? You better have sex when you're 20-something. You better do that. But most people can't do that. Most people don't, because there's this silent narrative going on. The Manosphere calls it game. Right, there is this strange thing going on that the institutions are not talking about. We are just animals, after all, but we're animals with rhetoric and understanding, and we come from many different psychosocial backgrounds. And because we have such a thing called a quote-unquote society that rules over us, we always are talking about society and civilization. What if I'm saying that society is a figment of our imagination?
So it's kind of like you're saying is just kind of a scrap everything and start from scratch. Like, it's kind of like that theory of like year one.
I'm just really talking about, you know, applying an alt-left or Asian studies or Asian philosophy in a nutshell. Really, I think the Western world is just sick in its own. It doesn't understand itself, and there's a government that's doesn't understand that we're animal or the natural way of living. It doesn't. It's unfair. that somebody could be 20-something, and basically somebody, other forces are telling him to do this, and maybe his biology is telling him he needs to settle down at that age, and basically, you know, do this and that. That's what our nature should be. But social status and other outside life is not letting this happen.
I know Andy Nowicki has that book, Confessions of a Would-Be Wanker, and it's basically about pretty much what you're talking about. And his thing is, in Confessions of a Would-Be Wanker, it's a philosophical book, and Andy Nowicki comes to the conclusion that just not that he doesn't care about all these different things that you're talking about, like status and proving yourself. But the thing is, I mean, I think from a philosophical sense, it's a strong argument, but people are going to be part of society. They're still going to be part of these under this pressure. And I mean, obviously, Andy Nowicki acknowledges that in his book.
I think he says there's a lot of claims that the dickhead theater director, you know, everyone getting a boyfriend, girlfriend, him trying to be like getting girls, you know, it's all this petty shit. That, and I sometimes think the fucking institution does this. Like, literally, they say, this is a safe space. No, the safe space was a criticism against the institution. But literally, literal institutions are now putting it as an indoctrination camp, right? You know, RAs, you know, these officers, like everyone in a dorm room, they, the Banduro, they're role playing again, the Bobo doll experiment, boyfriend, girlfriend, and then fucking break up at 25. And so it basically becomes like an inhumane slaughterhouse for destroying lives and making people crazy, creating more potential Elliot Rodgers or Elliot Rodger winners where they just get flatlined and sedated for the rest of their fucking life, right? You know, I treat everything now like a Discord server. When I was, you know, I was going to the Cherry Blossom Festival today, that was just a Discord server. I go to this place, it's just a Discord server. But always there's a dickhead in the Discord server that basically is living the psychosocial narrative and thinks self-actualization, they're with their gas sign and they're whatever, being around with it. But at the same time, it's a problem because your life doesn't matter. I guess I'm borrowing something from Max Stirner now with the ego in its own. I love Max Stirner, you know, and his book of, I read that really early on, and I always think this ego talk is true. People are not only just animals, but this rhetoric we're talking about is really just the aim for our own psychosocial narrative and for our egotism. I mean, I don't mean to be a nihilist or the Bret Stephenson kind of nihilist, but this,
I think nihilism is extremely unhealthy as a permanent stage, but I think nihilism serves a purpose as a wrecking ball to the kind of values of an existing society. Exactly. But that has to be replaced by something new. You can't have nihilism as a permanent state.
Maybe I'm just, you know, my solution, I guess, for this whole psychosocialist thing. So we have two options. Either we have total chaos, digital hardcore anarchy, where we become egotist and we rip the system, we do bizarre things, you know, alt-left, whatever, or we approve upon the psychosocial narrative. And I think that's really the spiritual war between, I don't even think the left-wing, right-wing. The left-wing, right-wing are under those forces. I think there's a psychosocial right.
Well, back to what I said about the whole kind of concept of loserdom and egalitarianism and situational losers is the leftist ideology is that everyone is equal, and there's just one human race, and that's all that matters. Then there's the notion that's kind of influenced by Calvinism, that you see in our kind of capitalist society that coexists with that. That narrative is that basically, if you're a successful person who works hard, if you have certain things in life, that means that you're a valuable person. But the thing is, there's a lot of people. There's this discussion about what is a genuine loser, what's a situational exactly loser. It gets complex, and that's completely kind of outside either of those narratives. I mean, obviously, egalitarianism is a lie because
yes,
some people are higher caliber than others on different levels, whether you want to talk about it in a materialistic sense or a more deeper spiritual sense either way. And the whole idea that people get what they deserve, a lot of people who have status and wealth in society are pretty worthless people.
Yes.
So pretty much both of those narratives are lies.
Exactly. You know, it's about work. You know, people, the manosphere argument, this silly alt-right argument is basically, if you're really worthy in society, Aaron Clary will say this too, you got to work for it. Well, there are some jobs out there, you do nothing and you get $1 billion per hour, and there's jobs working your ass off for 60 hours a week selling indirect sales to windows to house, and you have a disturbing life through that, and that's unethical, and it hurts people. And so that doesn't matter. So what's happening is there's this quiet social Darwinism happening. We're killing off valuable people. We need to give jobs, you know, I'm probably saying Bernie Sanders socialism here, but we need to have jobs to people who are worthy. You might have a handsome...
Well, not the kind of, not the left-wing version of socialism, but a more, like, a socialism that rewards the best people, like, encourages them to be successful. Some people in the alt-right talk a lot about, like, natalism, giving like economic incentives for the best people to reproduce. That's sort of popular with those alt-right types. And then there's this sort of idea I've heard put out, like a basic income, but a basic income that would favor people with higher IQs. I think that's basically what we need. We need to scrap corporate capitalism, but the left-wing model of socialism doesn't work either. I think we do need to go for this kind of we need to try something completely new.
Yeah, this new social Darwinism is hurting us because the nice kid is dying to the dumbass meathead skinhead that's winning. Like, there are dumbass, like, kids that, you know, never went to college or been to college and they degree in something shitty and stupid. And they're basically the jocks and they're winning society. They shouldn't win because they're normies and they propagate normie culture. The nice kid that's a yaoi, healthy-looking body, He's being killed out because he doesn't work. He doesn't apply to the normie, and that's a problem. That is definitely a problem.
I know this sounds like a simplistic or superficial solution, but because those types you're talking about are disproportionately high IQ, I mean, there's tons of scumbags who are high IQ, of course. I mean, just look at a lot of the people in power who have high IQs. But I think having a socialism that takes that into account wouldn't fix things completely, but it would sort out a lot of these problems we're talking about.
It's like Jonathan Bowden had something called the Pagan effect, he called it. And the Pagan effect goes like this. The more smarter you are, is the more beautiful you are, the more handsome you are, the more stronger you are morally good. And there's a contrast to that. The more ugly you are, is the more stupid you are, the more smaller you are, the more evil you are. That is called the pagan ethic, and according to Bowden, pagans believe that. We're living under this weird social Darwinian pagan effect, where it seems to me the jocks in school win, and people who are ugly lose. And what has been happening is that there's been this left-wing institution trying to reverse those rules, trying to reverse saying that the ugly person that looks like Noam Chomsky, that ugly little Jewish nerd, he's just as good and he deserves to be in a position of power. You know, that's all great, but it's this strange thing going about where you're people are told in liberalism, You should be good about yourself because you got an English degree. But what about the people who join the football team, the basketball team? They're getting fucking laid, and they're getting all this stuff happening, and they're becoming the CEOs, and you just rot staying at home because you never were those things. Why in the world do we worship hockey? You know, these hockey men, all white, go out on the hockey field and beat each other up and call them names. You would do that in real life. It's called domestic violence. But they're doing it paid professionally as millionaires to be criminals on the stage, right? And hockey is the biggest hypocrisy of them all. And so we have this social Darwinism, pagan effect thing going on, which is really, really bad because it justifies the manosphere. And as Greg Johnson says, the manosphere corrupts men. And okay, it shows you that what are we supposed to do? Lift weights every day, get a big tit girlfriend? in 1488 White Master Race. It's I'm something skeptical about that. And so if that was really authentically the truth, it just shows you how animal people are. But at the same time, that is a corruption that I'm totally against, because it is not about, you know, it is, you know, totally, supposedly people like that, the social Darwinian pagan effect theory, is because it goes against the whole psychosocial narrative. But then again, the psychosocial narrative, you know, could help that theory, what I just said. But it's more like a cheat that is unnecessary. I believe in a cheat, like this puppet master ghost in the shell thing, where it's like, you know, fuck the meathead skinheads and do your own thing. And, you know, you can be healthy too. You could still be a nice, skinny, beta male kid. I'm pro beta male. I am totally pro beta male. Have your nice Asian girlfriend and just, like, don't give a shit and do what you want. Avant-garde arts, right? But nobody seems to do that because everyone's wooed over by this image of whatever, the guy who's good at game. I just think it's a really weird corruption. You just have to draw the line and say that you are a byproduct, a victim of this current life you're in, and we deserve more. And we deserve to be at our best, and the system needs to give in to our demands of being better. So, I don't know.
We're getting close to the end of the show, but I think it's just so crucial to point out how much we are under this whole sort of psychosocial narrative. And, most people are just kind of oblivious to it. They just go along with it. And not just normies per se, but even people within all these, like, who consider themselves dissidents or whatever. Psychosocial problems are always going to be around, but our society is just so dysfunctional that it exacerbates these problems. Before I wrap things up, Pilliter, is there anything else you'd like to add to kind of summarize the show?
I think LARPing is very dangerous, and people LARP all the time, and our biggest problem is the American male that says, I have nothing to do with this. Why can't I just live a normal life? The problem is the normal life is a part of the problem, and that the normie is problematic because he is living the psychosocial life that you think it might be cute to live the first 3, 4, or 5 years of your life in a college dorm, and you have a girlfriend, you get to Chromecast and cuddle and have sex, and you tell everyone around the school that, you know, here's my picture of my girlfriend, we do everything, we go to basketball games, we do drugs, whatever. That's just the psychosocial narrative and effects, the Matrix. And to borrow cyberpunk coding, you take the red pill, you know, you don't get, you know, you go out of that and realize how everything is, we need to break out of that mold, because that is making life miserable. People are jealous. People want to ask questions. We're playing the game of psychosocialism, and we start to emulate. When people on the alt-right, in the anime right, they're just these losers of the psychosocial narrative that want to have the exactly of this meta-narrative I just said. And so, you know, everybody is themselves. Everybody can live up to their own standards, and we don't need to be bullied.
You don't mean that in the same way that, like, a lot of leftists do, that it's okay to basically not shower and be disgusting. I mean, there has to be standards. You're just saying, yeah, like, don't conform to artificial standards and values.
Yeah, I mean, some leftists take it to a... But once again, they're living the psychosocial narrative because they are role modeling off of other people. They listen to crustpunk and hardcore bands. They're living a psychosocial narrative. So, yeah, there is... Exactly right, Robert. And then just... we live in a society that basically role plays, and everybody wants to live out a certain life out of through they saw someone else do it. They want to live a good life, and so they answer these big questions about living that life. And so some people, we can be ourselves by following our own standards. And here's the biggest part. The biggest part is when you call out the enemy and you start being meta about it. When I say you're racist for doing stuff white people like, white people get mad is because they want to prove they're not racist. When you start saying that you're just a dipshit 22-year-old who does this and this and that, people get mad. when we become analytical about the narrative, we basically wake people up and red pill them. What I do is Asian Aryanism. I basically believe there's a bond, a psychosocial bond, between whites and Asians. I wrote the article for Asian Aryanism saying that this is a cause and effect of why Asian Aryanism is happening. It's because of psychosocialism. Now, if I was to tell more quote-unquote Asian Aryans that they're just a natural effect of the psychosocial narrative, they will get mad because they will start questioning their psychosocial narratives. But if they break it, they can understand what's going on. We can create institutions. And so I guess that's what the white nationalists did with the formation of, like, the alt-right. They start asking these big questions about what the fraudulent psychosocialism is and then asking it. It's what anime fans do on Twitter. They basically now unite through this imagined community, and they can finally understand and make an institution on their own. And so my lesson for psychosocialism would be to have an answer. And that answer is to create other new forms of psychosocialism, break out of it, or break the narrative. And, I would assume that we should be ethical about our decisions, and we should call out people who are normies, really. We should call out the normie that thinks he's something else and trying to be that. And we should challenge people so they can be more avant-garde and artsy, and then start listening to strange podcasts like this and creating better literature and better stuff and becoming better artists, because we just can't stand the normie. That's pretty much what I have to say about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Pillator, thanks for being on. It's been a great show.
It's nice talking to you, Robert, like always.